This interview is being conducted for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Project Number AN08-NJ7. The interview is being conducted by Sarah Corbin. I'm interviewing Dennis and Jane Demmer on April 26, 2012 at 10 in the morning at their home in Klawak, Alaska.
James Rowan Sr. is assisting with the interview.
Thank you for having me in your home.
You're welcome.
Can you please start by telling me when you were born and where you were born?
I was born in October 18th, 1932 in Klawak. My parents had a home here near the sawmill. excuse me. And I'm not sure how to correlate between the map and the recording, but you know where everything is here. But
which sawmill? I understand there were quite a few.
There was one sawmill here when I was growing up, and that was about midway between Sandpoint and the cannery. Sandpoint Trading Company, it was called.
So about where on the map was your folks' place?
Well, if you were to follow Bayview around to toward the cannery, there's a road coming down from the Totem Park. And if you're on the Bayview side coming toward that intersection, we were maybe 150 yards or so back toward town.
So where could you point to where it would be about?
It might have been, I see a house here.
And that was in 65 now, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think our house was probably gone by then.
Other people have referred to this as Demmert Sawmill?
Yes.
So, and they refer to this as a boat yard next to it.
A boat shop.
Boat shop. And was that?
That was also Demmert. That was below James Demmert's house. And that's where my father's first boat was built, the Joanna.
Can you tell me a bit about the history of the people who settled Klawak?
A lot of this was not passed on orally at the time that I was growing up. I learned later on some of the stories on it. I think that John Darrow had been interviewed by Ron Olson, and I think that's the best documented story of the people coming across Klawak, at least those stories, and alternatively, and that's within oral historic times, but Steve Langdon has spoken of fire pits near Klawak Lake that are several thousand years old, so that preceded the stories that Ron Olson gathered from John Darrow. But for my part, my clan, which is Kleinadi, Dog Salmon, Zorcrest, our house was in Tuxican, and we have a picture of that house, and in fact it's been published in a couple of different books. And if you look closely, you'll find the name Kukchak on the door, above the door. There, I think there's another Dog Salmon house. What confirms that that's our house was that's the name that I was given later on. So it was my uncle's name, and so it was our house with just a great Dog Salmon panel on it. But they came sometime around 1900, more or less. I had
That's what we were looking for, was figuring out that date, huh?
Yeah, my mother was born in 1903, and my recollection was that she was born in Texarkana. But stories about the move from Texarkana indicate that people moved here before that. But, you know, it may be that they didn't all move together, I'm not sure. In any case, sometime around 1900 or so, the people from Texarkana moved into Quahog. And people had moved from further north Chican, at the north end of the northwest end of El Capitan Pass. There's a village which was my father's village, Chican. And people moved in because of the canneries. All those stories that Steve Langdon collected indicated that education, compulsory education, was a part of it as well. That people were required to bring their children in to go to school. So those are stories that Steve Langdon, I was not aware of that, but Steve Langdon had spoken with people who told him of that. The Canadian moved in around the turn of the century.
Can you share some stories with me about growing up in Quahog and what you remember of playing or using the area around Bayview Boulevard, and who else used it, what activities?
Okay, as I said, my parents had their home across from the sawmill, but my grandmother lived further, what way is this, east, along Bayview Boulevard. There was a Presbyterian church, and I see someone had marked where it was. At least I'm sure that's what that indicates. There is a street up the hill to the Presbyterian church and Presbyterian manse, and my grandmother's house was at the corner of Bayview, and I think that may be called, I don't know, Manse Street or something.
It's called Manse Street today.
Yeah. Okay, but her house was at the corner at the bottom of the hill. And I remember that more than anything. I mean, I grew up mainly around my grandmother's house. Those are my first memories of Quahog. My grandmother's house. I remember that more than I remember the house where I was born.
When you were young, was Bayview Boulevard still a boardwalk?
I don't remember when it changed. I do remember that we had moved to Craig before I started school. And I started, I think it was just before my fifth birthday, which was in October. The Bureau of Indian Affairs schools were well, notoriously bad schools as far as the quality. I would add that I don't think it's because of the teachers so much as the inadequate funding, inadequate resources. But Quahog had a BIA school, and school was required, compulsory. And any community large enough had a Bureau of Indian Affairs school and a territorial school. Or schools, territorial being for the non-native children, and the BIA schools for Indian children. Ketchikan, Juneau, Sitka, all those had BIA schools and territorial schools. Some communities were too small for two schools. For example, Quahog had the BIA school. Craig, 7 miles away, had a territorial school. Craig was built as a cannery town, and many of those who came there were not Native people. The majority were not Native, but they had a territorial school there. My father moved his family to Craig before I started school, so my schooling was all in Craig, and except for part of my third grade year In 1941, early in 41, my father moved the family to Sitka because Japonski Island was being transformed into a Navy base. And so he moved the family to Sitka, where anyone who wanted to work could get work there. And he was a carpenter, and so he went to work at Japonski Island. And well, schooling was compulsory, so I had to go to school there. But in Sitka, unlike Craig Clark, there were two school systems, the territorial school and the BIA school. So I attended the BIA school. One of the things that I learned from that experience was just how much difference there was between the BIA schools and the territorial schools. I was an underage, undersized third grader. And many of the students in the BIA school were overaged and over, they're much bigger in each grade. And as an underage third grader, it was pretty obvious that by the standard in the BIA school, I was not a third grader. So I moved up to fourth grade and well beyond their capabilities. And then to fifth grade. And I remember the teacher having me read to eighth graders. And I could read, I was better at that than eighth graders in that school. That's just how the quality differed between the BIA schools and the territorial schools. Because the schooling that I had in Craig was far better than what was available in the BIA school. But I know that the teachers there were, there were some good teachers there. I have an older cousin, Ember Demmert, who happened to be teaching that school at the time. I remember Mrs. Cook, and she was good, but resources were not good. I remember that I had a friend in one of the upper grades. He was much bigger, but he just kind of took me under his wing, and we were really great friends. And I remember when I read to the eighth graders, I was kind of pleased about that, seventh and eighth graders. And he was a good friend of mine. I thought he would be too, but he never seemed to be. And I didn't understand that until I grew up. You know, I was really, I didn't intend on my part, but that was real put down to the eighth graders to have a little third grader reading to them with far better skills than they had. So for him, it didn't feel good to have that that occur. But anyway, that's just an aside to give you some idea of the quality of schools. My older two brothers went to the Kellogg School before going to Sheldon Jackson, the Presbyterian Mission School, which is where all of us except one of the nine brothers and sisters went to Sheldon Jackson. But that's aside from the archaeological work that you're doing.
Did you ever attend the school in Kellogg?
No, I didn't. I remember that. I don't remember if either Roy Pradovich or Elizabeth Pradovich, if either one of them was a teacher in the school. There was a nice house right next to the school where they lived. I remember because of, you know, when I was a child, I picked up the Kellogg habit pretty much of visiting, and people just visited each other. I really liked Roy and Elizabeth Pradovich, and I would go and visit them. I remember visiting them in their house, just going to visit, just because I liked them. But they had a house next to the school that I think was intended to be a teacher's house, and I don't know if there are any other governmental jobs there in Clark that that might have qualified them for staying there. But they lived in that house next to the school. But I never did attend that school. On your map here, I'm not sure if this is the sawmill, but I think it is. It was called the Demmert Sawmill. And I see east of that, southeast of that along Bayview is the another building sticking out there over the water, and that would have been a bowling alley.
Where was the bowling alley?
They're still piling down there. If you were to walk along Bayview,
mm-hmm.
there are some pilings still sticking out, and I'm sure that's what that was for, was the bowling alley. I remember setting pins in that bowling alley and the one in Craig. I think Al Widmark owned them both at one time or another.
That's what I was going to ask you, who owned it?
And going toward the cannery, I can see the top of a house that I think must be what is known as the big house. And that was one of the many buildings that that Charlie Demert moved in from canneries that were no longer operating, that were not in settled communities. He did that with several buildings. The two bunkhouses that continue to exist near the cannery were brought in by Charlie Demert. And the big house was, as I understand it, had a cannery out somewhere, I don't know where. And the fact that he brought it in and moved it that far up the hill, well, Charlie Demert was had a lot of skill. As I knew him, you know, he always walked with a cane, and he was not able to do physical work, but he moved buildings. And, he moved in those two bunkhouses plus his own house. The big house was moved before my memory. I don't remember that happening, but my understanding was he moved that in. But I recall in later years, Craig did not have an A&D hall, and they wanted one, and they bought a bunkhouse out in one of the canneries no longer used, and they wanted to move it into Craig. And, they'd asked a company, I guess, in Ketchikan, I don't know where it was, but if they would move it in for them, the Craig A&D. And whoever it was said no, it couldn't be done. So Charlie brought it in. And the story was that they put it on a raft, they lowered it onto a raft, and Charlie had them hook up a generator, and so they were towing it into Craig, and when they came into sight of Craig from around Fish Egg Island, he had them turn on the lights and start honking their boat horns and let them know that they were coming into town with this big lighted building coming down the channel. He had wanted to, my father had wanted to move it up into the middle of town. My father bought a lot there for the A&B, but folks were anxious to have it put up, and they voted instead to just raise it in the North Cove in Craig and just put piling under it and make it operational there, which they did. I don't know how long it continued there. It was very much used, but it was over the water, and eventually it fell into the bay.
When you were going to school in Craig, did you live in Craig during the school year?
I lived in Craig during the school year, and my father fished for the cannery in Kowalkin, and he was a good fisherman, and there were a number of, maybe they're just called shacks for workers who came in, and the superintendent particularly wanted him to fish there, and added on to one of the shacks for my father's family. And I see on your map there one that is marked, is larger, and we were on that end, on the east end of those shacks, and we did have a larger shack, if you will. And not only did they add on one bedroom, then they added on another one, so they made it a lot larger for him. But we would move to Craig in the summer, Quahog in the summer, and Craig in the winter. So I grew up in both Craig and Quahog.
Did you remember when the road was built along Bayview Boulevard?
No, I don't, but I do remember on one occasion when I was a child that there was a fire somewhere. The fire trucks had to go along there, and I remember that my cousin Archie Demert, who was quite a bit older than I, had a truck. And I do remember that Bayview at that time was passable with the truck. So that would have been late 30s, early 40s. I don't remember when that was. I remember fire, excitement, and jumping on the back of his truck and going to the fire.
I heard that it was built as part of a CCC project.
That could be. You know, the poles are part of CCC. Parked in the woods above the cannery, what might have been the bomb shelter from World War II. Clark had a bomb shelter.
How you doing?
Hi, good, how are you?
So.
Yeah, years later, after growing up, you know, I think it's amusing, and I'm chagrined that, you know, we had a bomb shelter during World War II in case they bombed Quahog. I remembered just after World War II starting that in Craig, and every village, I'm sure, had the same thing, you know, blackouts. Had to have every window darkened so the Japanese couldn't see us. They came and attacked Craig. But there was real concern about World War II and being attacked.
So where was the bomb shelter here?
Right here. It was a log building.
Well,
I'm sure that's what it was, because there was a trail up there. I don't remember if that was it, but it was up in here behind where we lived.
Yeah, I have had other people, that's why, you're right, that's why it's on here. Other people have said that that was the bomb shelter.
Yeah.
And that they used to play in it or other things. And it makes a bit of sense that it was somewhere in this area, because that's cleared out from vegetation. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't remember that it was in a cleared area. I was thinking that it was more directly behind our house.
You can draw on my map if you like.
Another line of thinking that would come into play would be, if you had a bomb shelter, you want it hidden, so it would be not in the open, but
in the woods.
In the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it seems to me that it was more nearly behind our, where we live. And there were a row of small shacks below the big house as well. And I see you have something marked there. I remember that Paul Demert, before he moved to, I guess he moved to Petersburg and then Angoon. But he had one on the west end of those three or four, and Oscar Demert had one on the other end. And I see a house that may have been Tom Hollywood's house. There was the big house, and then the next one over was Tom Hollywood. And then the next one over was probably James Demert. And then right at the bottom of the hill coming down from the Totem Park right at the intersection there was this Enniskett house. Up further up the hill, coming down from the park where was the McNeil, which is what may be the marked house there. I see a little red mark there. But Charlie McNeil lived up there, Charlie and Joe. Don't remember another brother's name. And incidentally, you do have and you do know about the Sandpoint Trading Company, I think it was called, the store there. Al Widmark operated that store, and Archie as well.
Who is Archie?
Archie is the son of Charlie Jenner. he eventually got a teaching degree and a master's degree. I think I still have his master's thesis downstairs from University of Alaska. But he taught in a number of communities, including St. Lawrence Island out in across from Russia. And one year was Teacher of the Year for Alaska and one of the five finalists for a National Teacher of the Year. So.
Was this Kloak store at Sandpoint originally started as part of the Bureau of Education? Was it the store that was started for as a Kloak cooperative for the Native?
It may have been a cooperative. I don't remember the BIA's rule in particular. I recall in my earlier conversation with you and Mark that there were beads found along there on both sides of the street. But it reminded me, and I wonder if those were really trade beads or if they were beads that were jewelry that had not been sold in the store whenever it closed and might have been part of the inventory. The reason I think that is I remember as a little boy that they had a showcase there with a lot of jewelry in it. There's one piece in there that I really thought was a beautiful piece of jewelry. And I saved and saved. And my mother's birthday was August then. And I saved enough money to buy that necklace for her. Looking back, it's probably pretty gaudy, but I thought it was great. But I remember they had those things in that store. It was just a lot of jewelry.
Yeah. Did other stores, I know there were other stores along Bayview Boulevard, did they also sell jewelry? Do you recall?
No, I don't. But I remember there was just a general store, and then next to it there was a soda fountain. I mean, they were joined together under the same roof. One of them was a soda fountain.
Yeah, these are some of the beads that people had shown.
Yeah, some of these look more like the trade beads than what I'd seen. What I'd seen were maybe along the lines of that.
Yeah, those are pretty nice looking. Older.
Yeah. Yeah, those are more trade beads. That's not what was.
Some of the elders, the ladies, remember the beads being all over the place and everybody having them and kids playing with them, and they thought they were just everybody had them.
Yeah.
Do you remember your mom having anything like that?
Well, I didn't pay that much attention other than than the one that I got for her. She worked down at the cannery, and she put the can covers into the machine where they put the covers on the cans. I remember she wore this to work, the necklace that I'd gotten for her birthday.
Do you recall if it seemed expensive, the necklace? Did you have to save a long time?
I saved for me, it seemed like, but you know, I did save, and I did think turn money, and in fact, I worked in Sand Point for 25 cents a day or something like that. And I worked at the cannery with the Filipinos making boxes, and one superintendent there had a son about my age, Dick, I can't remember his name, but Dick was about my age, and his father was superintendent. So, you know, if you wanted to work, his father found work for him to do. Well, he and I were good friends, so I got to work with him. And we would make boxes came flattened. They had really good boxes. And what the Filipinos would do would be to staple the bottoms. And that was something that a kid my age could do. I don't know what age I was, but that was kind of fun. I open up the box, put it in there, and then step on that lever, and the staples would, and there was a certain way you did it. Two on one side, two on the other side, and then two more toward the center, and then the same turn around. But I got to work. I don't remember how much we got paid. I think the superintendent paid us out of his pocket. We weren't on the payroll. But that was how I earned money, was things like that. I don't remember if there are other things we did, but those are a couple of things.
I had heard a story about Sandpoint being a place where folks were cremated before they started being buried. Did you ever hear any stories like that?
No, I hadn't. And I see someone had drawn in the boardwalk that went from next to Bob Pradovich's store out to the business offices and then on out to the cannery. But it looks to me as though was this the cannery here, I wonder?
I am not certain. I think that may have been the cannery.
The warehouse?
But there were also some buildings out here, I was told.
Right, right. So. Well, but what I'm thinking is that the walkway went right next to the cannery.
I don't know if anything is left by that picture of that cannery.
Doesn't look
that. The boardwalk seems to be gone.
Well, I'm not sure if that's a boardwalk there or not. But if that's the roof of the cannery, the walk, but the angle looks as though it'd be further out, but my recollection is it went right along the cannery. And there was, excuse me, the must have been the warehouse out here, and what I thought was a warehouse may have been the boiler and so forth. And by the way, you probably know that where those boilers are on the beach, where the sawmill, I mean, where you'll see boilers there, that's where the sawmill was. And this one still does have the show hall in it. The movie theater that Bob had.
Do you remember when the water and sewer lines first went in along Bayview Boulevard?
No, I don't. Remember Bob Kravitz had both a movie theater and a store along Bayview. And there are three buildings there. There's a boardwalk that went out to the canyon, and then next to it, east of the boardwalk, was Bob Kravitz's store, and then next to that was the movie theater. Then next to that was my grandmother's woodshed, and the outhouse for her house was in that same building over the water. I mean, there was no indoor plumbing that I'm aware of at the time. I don't know if Bob Kravitz or any of his family might have had, but and when Bob's store burned down, there was another building along just before you get to the A&B Hall that he used as a store after his big store burned out. So he continued to have a store. And I see Frank Kravitz's store is marked. So to answer your question about stores, there were those. Bob Kravitz is in one location, then another. And then Frank Kravitz is on the road coming down from the school out to the cannery offices, right at that intersection there. about halfway between the A&B Hall and the Sandpoint store.
Can you tell me at all about Kluwak as a reservation and the land status?
Well, that's something that I was not particularly aware of at the time. I do recall in Craig, after we'd moved there, there was not an A&B Hall in Craig. And so meetings were held at my parents' home in the living room, and I remember conversations there about land. As a child, it was not that, it was over my head, but I remember names like, I still remember Harold Ickes was one of the people I was discussed, and you know, learned later on that he was the Secretary of Interior, and William Paul, and probably James, I can't remember his name, but others that were involved with the Bureau of Indian Affairs or land issues. I remember land was a concern, but you know, so far as the content of those discussions or the rationale involved, I don't have a sense of that at all.
Do you know how people came to build their houses on the certain lots or around town? How did someone select a place where they lived, or how did they get to build a house somewhere?
Well, you know, in 1908, the Allotment Act was amended to include Alaska, Indian Allotment Act, and I think that there were probably mixed messages coming from the Bureau to the Indian people about getting allotments. I have seen a letter from Felix Cohen, who's a great guru of Indian law, to the secretary of the A&B from the 1940s or 50s, And the gist of it, as I recall, and I think I still have that letter somewhere in my mixed files. The gist of his message was that some people tell you not to go for reservations. And his advice was don't pay attention to that. Go ahead and get them. Which was good advice in retrospect. But people did get allotments. My grandmother had an allotment for her land. And she also had an allotment for a land west of the cannery, which is where she had a storage, what do you call it, underground storage for her potatoes and other vegetables.
Like a cache of some sort?
That's not the word. But anyway, she did have an allotment for that. But allotments, the other aspect of allotments that was problematic was that the language of the Allotment Act was that you could obtain allotment title, if you will, to the lands that you'd been using. And the interpretation of some of the bureaucrats was, okay, so you had to show and document usage back to 1908. That was when it was amended. We didn't have documents. So that pretty much negated some efforts to get allotment land. And some people wouldn't bought it. And I recall that when we were working on the land settlement in the 1960s, what the lawyers knew and advised us accordingly was that when it became obvious that we're going to get a settlement act passed, he made the point that the Allotment Act would probably be repealed with the passage, which is what happened, by the way. But he said, if you have an allotment claim in before that passes, the way the law works is that if you have the claim in before the Indian Land Settlement Act passes, you have a right to have that considered and get an allotment title. So the AFN made a big effort to get people to file allotment claims. I did not because, through the A&B, I was president of A&B in Ketchikan, I didn't have a lot of confidence that they would be honored, so I didn't even bother. It was a mistake. I should have filed an allotment claim because it really didn't work out that way. That not very well. It took a long time. I think that by law they're supposed to settle those claims within a period of so many years, maybe 5 years. They didn't do that. Extended, still didn't do that. And I don't know if they have them all settled now, but those claims were, if they were on record, and some people talked about them being lost, but the Allotment Act did, some land transferred. I remember George Demert has, his family still has an allotment out on Hakata Island. What's that bay? Do you remember, James? You know where the old totem was heading north?
Oh, yeah.
What's the bay in there? I can't remember the name of it.
Shipley?
No, or, that's further north. But. Anyway.
Halcon or?
I can't remember. If I saw it on I know exactly where it is in my head, but. But Sitquay had, and George Demert had an allotment there, and James Demert has an allotment at 11 Mile Point outside of Chicane. So some people got them. And my grandmother had a couple of allotments. But how they determined where they would have land, I don't know. But I'm guessing that with all of the activity that Charlie Demert brought a lot of economic activity to Kowloc, and with his brothers, and my guess is that with the kind of economic activity that he brought, that he needed land accordingly. He needed land for the sawmill. There's the boat shop. There's the oil dock and the cannery and the bunkhouses. All of that required land, and the brothers, the Demert brothers, I'm talking about the Demerts now. I think probably Charlie. What the unit was in town that would have said who could settle where, I think that that portion of land was probably somehow made available for Charlie to do all the building that he did. The brothers worked together on the building, but Charlie was pretty incredible in what he could do. So I can see where my father was, James Demert, Oscar Demert, Paul Demert, Charlie Demert. And Romaine Hollywood was raised as a sister. I'm not sure the relationship. She may have been someone's. She was closely related. She grew up as a sister. And her house was right next to Charlie's. So it appears that a large chunk of that property somehow was transformed into the economic activities of Kowloc and then the homes for the brothers. And, you know, when you raise the question, how was the land selected, it just raises that line of thinking in my mind. If you take a look at the map, you know, that portion is pretty well consolidated where all of that economic activity took place, from the sawmill to the cannery.
And from my understanding with other folks in interviews, this seems to have been a lot of the Pradovich family lived over here by the island and on this backside of the slough.
Right, around the island. Let's see. I vaguely remember the road going up to the health center. I think that's a pretty rough road in that area. But the Pradoviches were over in here. Nick Pradovich was here. Bob Pradovich was up above his store right there, I think. And I think there may have been another Pradovich there, and then up here was what was Eleanor Pradovich's husband's name?
Francis?
That Tom?
Francis?
Yeah. Dosk. Yeah, they lived up above the Totem Park, as I recall. If I'm remembering he was up high, and I think it was there. There's that blue house there now. So they were, the Pradoviches were from here to around here and in this area here. And then Frank had the store over here. And then Bob had this portion here. And Peter Keene was married to Helen, who was daughter of Robert Padovich. They had a house here, right next to my grandmother's. So, yeah, that was... And the Rowans, I think, were right around here somewhere. And I think Jim Armour was a little bit over there, across the street. And I'm trying to recall some of the others that were... I can visualize people, but I can't remember names always. James Armour was just a very much respected elder who lived down along here somewhere. Do you remember which house he had?
No.
Someone did tell me that was the Armour's house.
That's what I thought. And Frank Woods was along here. And Bill Demert had maybe that house. And the Catos. And I remember the Smiths were up in this area here, but I can't visualize where they were. I remember growing up, you know, after the Totem Park had been built, the old totems were discarded down along here. I remember we used to play around there and, you know, crawl over them and so forth, but they're just discarded. And I didn't have any sense of their value, and obviously others didn't either. But the coffins were up there. And I think I saw a picture of one of them. You remember there's one holding, is it a spear?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think the original had it the other way.
Oh, yeah.
Where?
I got a mirror image of it.
Yeah. I think I saw a picture of it, maybe in Texican, with him holding it the other way from the way it currently is.
Yeah.
So the old totems, were they then left here? Do you know what ever happened to those?
No. I think Jane and I were working on Totem Heritage Project in the 70s, and we may have looked at those. I don't remember if Jane remembers that, but they were just discarded there and they were rotting there. And I was looking to see if they might still be visible as a stack, but... And I'm trying to think of anything that there might be of archaeological interest along Bayview. And I'm not sure what there would be. And in looking at this picture of the tide line, I can see where the probable high and low tide marks are. Maybe it would have been built up from the beach, so it's raised above the what would have been the beach level. So probably quite a ways down below the street itself is fill. That's just a guess. So anything that was of archaeological value might be below the fill that's there, which is probably where the pipelines would go in. That's just a guess. My guess is it's all going to be in that fill. So.
Do you remember your family or other families doing drying eggs or seaweed or processing their fish or collecting shellfish, chopping wood, any of those sort of activities along the shore?
Yeah, my grandmother's around her house, and I remember other people doing it. I remember going up toward the Totem Park from the Demert side, but there's another family besides McNeil's that I can't remember, and I seem to remember them drying fish eggs on branches. And I remember toward, along the beach side toward the armors, people drying fish eggs. On the beach between the sawmill and the armors, I seem to remember that it's nothing that I registered as something I need to remember, but I just, when you asked the question, I do remember that. And I'm sure that there were other places where I'd seen it, I can't visualize it all.
And do you remember, or what do you think people did with their trash?
Dumped it on the beach. In Craig, my father bought a house that had a small dock, and one of my chores was just take the trash and dump it off the end of the dock in Craig. I don't remember in Quahog. There was no such thing as garbage collection. I think it was just an individual responsibility to get rid of your trash. And I'm trying to recall what we did in Quahog, but I just don't remember. But I do remember Craig, and I think that might have been representative. But you took care of your own and dumped it where you could. That's just, again, a guess. That part I know. I know we did in Craig. You remember over time there was that big pile of cans and so forth at the end of the dock, end of that little dock that we had. It was a private dock, so that my father owned. He bought it with the house.
Do you think there's anywhere along Bayview Boulevard that should have an archaeological monitor if they're replacing water and sewer lines?
It depends on what counts as being of archaeological interest so far as how far back you go. As I said, I think for the earliest years, before Bayview was put in, my guess is a lot of that is below the fill line. Out on the water side, below Bayview. What I'm trying to visualize is what places might have been in earlier times of use and value. And I think in toward James Armour's and by the sawmill and the bowling alley would have been, there's the island out there that would be helped to shelter that area.
So that would be somewhere before the canneries came in, before...
Yeah, but Quahog is pretty well sheltered anyway, mm-hmm. So I don't know that people would necessarily come to that area, but as I say, that's Jim Armour's there, and he was very much respected, and that may be some indication of why he chose that area. It might have been a place that was of use for, as a good place to come into. But and then, of course, there's the island out there. I see there were still houses on that island at the time, and I had been told that there were graves out there. It's an island that we had a little... nobody went out there. It seemed to be something that just didn't happen. People just didn't go out there.
Was there a name for that little island there?
I don't remember a name. So I guess that is the bridge there then, huh?
I believe so.
Yeah. There's a little island here, and I think there are headstones on this island as well. Do you know?
I heard of
in the inner bay, there's an island, and there had been, I think, a power plant on that island at one time. But I think there may be one or two headstones out there too.
Yeah, did one have like a land otter on top of it?
I just don't remember.
And that is that known as Chuck's Island?
I don't remember that. It could be Billy Chuck. I know that somewhere in that area. Yeah, I'm getting a better sense of the lay of this now. And at one time there had been a Salvation Army hall right in here.
Would you draw that on, please?
Sure. It was I may be making it oversized, but it was somewhere in the dip, between the two islands. The island clock is on the little island, and it was on the inner bay side of that. And I think I've seen pictures of Salvation Army bands that were taken there at that. In front of that building. And I'm just trying to recall who else lived on that island. I don't recall going out there very often. And my grandmother had a store right in that might be Nick Pradovich's, and she had a store right about there, I think. There was a small building upstairs, 3 or 4 steps. And I don't know that she sold a lot, but she had grandchildren that she dearly loved, and candy was one of the things she sold and got for kids. And that was a great thing, was just being able to give candy to the kids out of her store. They had her number. They knew how to get candy from her.
Kids can be pretty good at that.
At that time, or when my oldest brothers were quite young, one of the things was, uniforms were one thing, and military, like Navy uniforms, and kids had some of those things. And I remember my brother, oldest brother, Franklin, had a Navy uniform. He eventually went in the Navy. If you recall what Cracker Jack looks like, the box, there's a picture of a little boy in a Navy uniform. Saluting. And Franklin would do that for his grandmother. She thought that was great. Imitate the Cracker Jack box. And I think probably got Cracker Jack for it.
Where would he have gotten the uniform?
Probably Sears. Sears was pretty common when I was a kid.
Could people do catalog orders in Kluwak when you were growing up? And did the stores bring in those catalog orders, or how did that work?
Yeah, there were catalogs around when I was a kid. Catalogs were the toilet paper supply. So I do remember that when I was young. Was catalogs were used in the outhouses.
Do you recall?
But I remember my mother ordering from the catalog. What years, I don't know, but when I was quite young, they could order from there.
Do you recall which catalogs in particular?
Well, there were two. Sears was the main one, but there's also Montgomery Ward. And that was pretty much it. And a lot of our clothes came from Sears. So.
Do you recall if that was a mailing operation, or if you would go into one of the stores and go through them?
Well, there were no stores that we ordered. Maybe from Seattle or Chicago, I don't remember where. But the orders were mailed out. And there was a mail boat that would come around to all the villages, maybe every Thursday or so, in Crater Fall. The mail boat went around the island to the different communities, Craig, Clock, Heidelberg, where else, I don't know. But mailboats came in. That's what they were called, mailboats, and brought in the mail.
Is there anything else that comes to mind that you'd like to know about Bayview Boulevard, or?
Well, in terms of what you're looking for, I since I met you and Mark on the ferry, I've been thinking about that. And the only thing I could think of was, some of the beads around Sand Point might have been from after the store closing, but that would have been on the beach side. I think you found some on the beach side and on the upper side of the road. And that wouldn't explain the upper side unless kids had come around and scattered them. But the beads you showed me are not what he was selling. So, what? And the beads that you're speaking of more likely were trade beads.
And you believe that the store sold smaller beads, maybe? Or?
I think they did. I'm visualizing the store on, I remember two counters in the store. When you walked into the store, the two counters were to the left, and there's one counter, and that's where you went for your groceries and so forth. And then there's a walk. There was an opening that went into the soda fountain. And then there was another counter that was more for hardware and maybe the beads and that kind of thing. So, yeah, they had things like that there. But I recall that distinction between them. I mean, they're next to each other, but if you were buying groceries, you went to this counter. And if you wanted other things, they're at the other counter. So.
One of the gentlemen in town who finds beads along the beach and collects them, he has quite a collection, he told me yesterday that he finds the trade beads in the entire length of the beach around Bayview Boulevard. Mm. And some of the ladies, as I mentioned, told me that they remember the beads, those trade beads, just being everywhere, and she can even remember playing jump rope with a strand of them.
So. Well, in one way that makes sense, in that Bayview is a boardwalk, is more in historical times, and people had smaller boats, not seine boats that had to tie up at the floats. They had smaller boats, including canoes and boats, and so their access from trade and so forth and fishing they would come to the beach. So the beaches were fairly commonly used then. I mean, who goes on beaches anymore? There was nothing like that. But the beach was just a part of what you did. I mean, I remember my Uncle Henry being down on this beach here, sawing logs for firewood, for example. But people were on the beach. And so it was just a part of the daily routine, was being on the beach. You went out somewhere, your boat was down below your house, and you got in your boat and pushed off. When you came back to the same place. And so beaches were very commonly used. And I don't know if anybody walks on beaches anymore other than around the park. But yeah, so I think it's understandable that if they were getting trade beads, you know, they're obviously not manufactured here. They're brought from somewhere, and they brought them in probably on small boats.
Yeah. And one of the ladies told me as well that Klawok had been a regular trading place for people from around the area, and she felt that those beads could have been part of that. Do you know about Klawok being a trading area?
I don't know it as a trading area, but I do know that it became a center for the villages around because of the two canneries. And you know, the first cannery being in Klawok, and then later the Bradwich cannery and the Dimmer cannery. The canneries pretty much pulled in the people from the outlying villages, Tuxican, Chican, Carheen, any place else, those villages where people left them and came into Klawok. And so it was a center in that respect. It was seen as a trading center. It could be just because of being a center for fishing purposes that may have seemed like center for other purposes. But all of those surrounding villages were no longer occupied. So.
And she may have meant earlier, before the canneries, too, that it was a trading center.
Well, it's a possibility, you know, because Claw Creek is a very rich resource. And it is one where people could come. And as I say, according to Steve Langdon, you know, there's the fire pits that are thousands of years old. I don't remember how old he said, but they're quite old. So, but because what would have been of interest in prehistoric times, or pre-contact times, would have been the resources. And Klawok is a good resource center, so it makes sense that people would come here. And it's very well protected as well. So.
Had you ever heard any contact era stories about Russian or Spanish or American traders coming in this far?
No, I've heard of them later on. You know, I'm sure you must be aware of Olson's book on Spanish contact in Alaska. It's very extensive coverage of that. From time to time, I think in later years, I've heard stories handed down, but nothing. I don't remember hearing anything earlier. So.
Had you ever heard a story about the fate of Chirikov's lost men marrying Tlingit and moving to Klawok?
Well, I've heard different stories, yeah. And, you know, my grandfather, David Roberts, this There are different stories about him coming to Cuyahoga. He was known as Russian Bob. And the Downhowers have recorded the different versions of that. One goes back to the Battle of 18-3 in Sitka. Another goes back to the time of the Treaty of Session. Because of time, generations, it seems that the one related to the Treaty of Session makes sense that Russian Bob would have been a child at that time. And the story is, that he and his sister were brought down from Sitka and raised down here. And I remember my father telling the story about the Russian, about the sister who I think, as I recall, was related to the Darrows. You know, when you hear these stories as a child, kind of boring, You don't realize you're hearing some pretty important stuff.
Yeah.
And can't wait to excuse yourself. Your question again was about...
If you had heard any of the stories about Chirikov's men eventually settling in Kowal.
I've heard them, but in ways that I can't recall when, but stories like that. And I know the story from the written historical accounts of them coming in and not coming back. What happened on the other end, I don't recall anything that I've filed away anymore in my mind. Charlie Demmert had quite an image, and as a child I was kind of a little leery of him always, but I don't recall him ever smiling or joking or laughing or anything like that, I remember someone telling me once that they were trolling, and Charlie ran the sawmill, the cannery, and the oil dock between the sawmill and the cannery, sold oil there. But I remember one person telling me, that he went and got his oil, and I guess Charlie must have known how fishing was, and so he went to pay, and Treasure said, don't bother paying, but don't tell anybody either. He would do it selectively, but if it became known that he was doing that, what would happen? And he didn't want his wife to know either that he was giving away oil. In spite of his all business demeanor, he had a real sense of need. I'm looking at this picture and I just think of him growing up in this area and remembering playing around the old bomb shelter and outboard motors out in the bay and going back in the back bay and getting crab apples along here.
Where did the crab apples come from?
There were trees along the beach just beyond the last house. I don't remember the road going as far as the map shows it. I mean, this picture shows it. I remember them about halfway along that. Oh, it's a little further around the corner. There were a couple of houses along there. And I can see a different color tree there. I don't know if this was what time of the year this was taken, but the darker ones, which are, well, they're shadows, I guess. But I do remember that. Now, I don't know that I've given you anything.
Oh, you've been tremendously helpful. Well, it's just absolutely fascinating to listen to. So, thank you very much. Yeah, no, it's definitely been very helpful. Is there anything else that you think that I should know or this project should know?
Outside of your picture here is the end of the island across from Klawock. And there's a nice little cove in there, and that's where Clara Adams' parents had a smokehouse and maybe a house as well. But I remember Clara Adams and her mother going over there in a canoe. And they had that nice little cove there.
You ever remember if there was like a stone fish trap out in front of that bay at the point?
You mean up by the Adams place? Or?
Yeah, right up in front of there.
Well, I don't remember that. And I'm trying to remember the names of families that lived across the bay. Henry Roberts Jr. lived over there for a long time before he went into the senior housing, but there were other families along that side, and I just can't remember which ones there were over there. Do you know?
James Martinez said he had his family had a house right along here.
Mm-hmm.
And
And then I think he moved to Craig.
Yeah. I just remember we had a garden plot over here next to beside Henry's place.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I remember people had gardens there. And I see this big building and I remember it, but I just remember. I don't remember what it was. Some kind of boathouse or what?
Does it make sense that as people started moving from the other villages into Klawock, that the town was first centered around where the original cannery was, and then as people moved in, they started settling the rest of the area?
It does make sense, I think, that it couldn't have happened that way. As I say, the Demerts moved in from Chican, and it makes sense that the people who had been in the inner harbor and that the area where the cannery is still pretty well sheltered. Not as sheltered as the inner harbor, but still adequately sheltered for building a cannery. So, yeah, likely the village would have been there and further up around the Klawock River as well. You know, there was if you were to roll up to Klawock Creek, the Big Berries, which we did when I was a kid, I remember there was a totem pole on the right side as you went up to the creek. I remember we used to crawl over that totem pole. And so there must have been some houses there at one time, even further up, even further into the sheltered area, near the fish. So my guess is that the stream itself was, you know, the real draw.
But do you remember the village extending up into the more sheltered area when you were young? Or had people moved out to this beach area by then?
What I recall is my first memories are from around my grandmother's house, which would be in the sheltered, more sheltered than around the cannery, and near the stream, but still out a little ways. So my guess is, you know, that they did move out there. And of course, if you were all the way up in the stream, that means you'd have to go that much further out to get out to other places for fishing as well. So the center of town where Bob Pradvich was might have been in pre-contact times, you know, just an ideal location.
Have you heard any stories about the original village being up along by the hatchery area, where the hatchery is now?
No, I hadn't, but that's where Steve found that the areas where I think it was fire pits were somewhere around the hatchery area. But no, I hadn't heard of settlements there. And again, my memories of, you know, what I witnessed, and that was mainly in the central part of what was then the central part of Quahog, and the being kind of a draw in the Salvation Army. No one else had mentioned the Salvation Army Hall being there?
People had talked about the Salvation Army, but I didn't have a chance to have anybody else draw it on the map, but other people did mention it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have seen pictures that I'm sure were in front of that building of the Salvation Army band. Let's see, there's Canoe Pass, which is not passable anymore, I guess, is it? Or is it? Can you get through there anymore?
Yeah, the tides are high.
Yeah. But there's also a bridge over it, right?
Yeah.
So that would limit you. But my guess is that in earlier times that would have been an easier way going back and forth. I remember when I was growing up, there was a man an older man who was blind, Jumbo. And I remember he must have had some maybe blurred vision. He was said to be blind, but he did fish hand trolling out of hole in the wall. And I remember that he would just take off rowing and somebody would pick him up and, you know, tow him out there. But I do remember that he rowed a lot. And he fished. And his camp out at Hole in the Wall was just inside. Hole in the Wall is between two islands, very nicely sheltered. And there's, once you come into the pass there between the two islands, you're immediately in a sheltered area. But you have to go past the little cove on the right, and that's where he lived. And nice, easy access, you know, in 5 minutes he could be out where he could fish. Growing. But he rode back and forth outside the entrance to Hole in the Wall. And, When my brother was lost, let's see, my brother was born in Holland Lost, so we had a stone up there, but it got knocked over. We now have it in Craig. But Holland Lost was a great summer place for a co-op. You remember that?
You remember going out to Holland Lost?
Yes, I do. We would go out, one of my very first memories as a little child was standing at the gunwales of my father's boat on the way out to Holland Lost. Still an early memory that I have was going out there. And I remember the inner harbor where the kids played and on the beach and picked berries up behind the village. There's a stream right through the center of town where we got our water. And I remember that there'd be the little I didn't know what they were at the time, but you know, there was a mosquito larvae in that water. You get some water out and there'd be this little thing looked like a black cross in there. Be at the top of the water, you touch it and it'd go down the bottom. You know, it's a very small natural stream. Someone must have dug out a place where we could get our water.
When did people stop going out to Holland Lost?
I don't remember when they stopped. We were going out in the 40s. And I think maybe we stopped. Our family may have stopped sometime in the 40s. Yeah, we would have stopped in the 40s. My parents moved to Craig in 1950 or so. I was away at school. And so that's when my parents stopped, was sometime in the late 40s. It was a great place. I really liked Holland Lost. And I can still remember. You know, we just had a great time out there. A lot of fun playing. I remember Indian baseball was a favorite. Did you ever play that?
No. Never had a chance. I hear a lot of people talk about it, though. It
had different rules. Some of them made up on the spot, I think. But I remember that anytime, you know, the ball was usually rags tied together. And the bats were just sticks, driftwood, or whatever. And if your bat hit the ball at all, that was a hit. And there's no such thing as a foul ball, it was a hit. And you start running. And you could run either way. If you hit the first base, you could run to third base. And then when the third person struck out or was put out, the team in the field immediately had to get to home base, I think it was. But if they didn't get to home base, the team that just went out could start tagging the other team. And if you tagged three of them, you went back to bat again. It was just a great different kind of game. It was always a lot of fun. Scorekeeping was always an argument about who got what points and so forth. That didn't make a whole lot of difference. It was just it was a game it should be for just fun.
Yeah.
How did you pick teams?
I think maybe pretty much as people pick teams, and I think that whoever decided on a ball game, say let's have a game, would immediately pick somebody and then the other side could pick someone. But whoever decided to play the game got the first pick. I mean, it's just that you announced and said, I'm getting so-and-so. And the little guys, got picked at the end. But it was a great game. And it really was just fun. Scores didn't mean that much. Score was kept. Different scorekeepers had different scores. And I remember the beach in Kalak where we played that. Also, at that time, I don't know how long that kept on, but playing boats was another game that we played. And people would make nice little model boats and get a piece of string and a stick and drag it along the beach in the water.
Was that an activity that boys and girls would play? Or just boys, do you remember?
Mainly boys. I think girls did as well. I think my sister Joanna did. But it was, I think it was mainly the boys. I remember as a little kid, I was too small to know how to make anything like that, but I remember finding a chip of, I guess, spruce bark and putting a bow on one end and a nail, and that was my boat. It got a lot of laughs. It was a funny little boat. And my uncle, Peter Roberts, who was a good boat builder, he thought I was getting too much teasing for my boat. He made me a nice little boat. The nicest boat out there was the one that Peter Roberts made for me. So I started with this funny little chip of bark to a boat that looked like the Thelma Jane. Thelma Jane was the boat that he built.
Did Peter Roberts build boats for the cannery or for the fishermen?
Well, he built his own boat, and my father built his own boat. I think people helped each other out, and I know other people built boats mainly for themselves, I think. And although the cannery had several boats that Charlie named, John Quinnett was one of them. He didn't operate boats, but he had someone else operate them. One of his sons' name, Quinnett, was a family name. Q-U-E-N-E-T-T-E. John Quinnett was his son that was drowned, I guess. But the boat was named for him. And I can't remember other boats. There was a Rex was a Kalak boat. Do you remember who had that?
I don't know.
Is that the Billy and I, the last one that was built in Kalak?
Probably, yeah. Justiniano was built in Kalak. That was Bill Demmert's boat. And when Leroy Demmert was a little boy, my cousin Bill's son, Bill Jr. is about my age. His father was my first cousin. And Leroy was a few years younger than Justin. The boat was named for Justin Deanna, the boat that they built. So, and they built this other bigger boat, limit-sized boat. The story is that his uncle was asked Leroy what they should name the new boat. And kind of there were two boys there that his sister had a boat named after her, and then there's Billy, and then there's Leroy. What should we name the new boat? Kind of a challenge, should it be after Billy or after Leroy? And he said, Billy and I. That was the name that he said it should be named. He said, Justin's got a boat name for it, named Billy and I. So that was the name of the boat. So. But, you know, that's kind of representative of something that I observed when I was director of Native Studies at the University of Alaska, was even then, generations later, there was still an influence in regard to how people shared and deferred. And I mean, he didn't want it named after him, but named after he and Billy. And I recall telling students when they had an organization, well, you have to select somebody to be in charge. And they never liked to select someone, so they'd have two or three people or whatever. Just a fair amount of deference. I could never imagine all this being transformed into a part of the city of Quahog.
When you were young,
yeah,
you wouldn't have imagined?
No, not at all. I mean, this was Quahog here. And to me, it made sense that someone should build there, but that's never happened. It's just not. It isn't even considered, it seems to me. I'm not aware of it being considered, and obviously no one has ever built on that island. And I'm wondering if there's some significance to that. I don't know.
Yeah.
James pointed out some grave areas on the island. We walked over there yesterday, and he pointed out some grave areas to me. Is that possibly a reason why people wouldn't have built their,
probably,
their,
yeah,
burying folks?
Yeah. And you know, there's a grave island out on the other side of Canoe Pass as well that had buildings on it when I was growing up. The main cemetery when I was growing up was on Frederick Island across the bay, which is where my grandparents are buried.
Is there somewhat of a trend to burying people on islands or burying them across the water from the village?
I don't know, but you know, if you're living on an island like this, there's not much room for a cemetery. But to try to answer your question, that was the case here, and it's also the case in Heidelberg. Heidelberg is across the bay on an island. And Craig's is on an island next to it. Not correctly, not a traditional native community.
I guess I'm wondering if, since burying people is a relatively recent tradition amongst Tlingit, if there was something about not having the graveyards near the towns for any purpose, or have some geographical separation.
Yeah, I'm not sure of that.
Do you ever remember the cannery workers that came in during fishing season?
Yeah, Filipinos came in. There were two bunkhouses, one for the Filipinos and one for the white cannery workers. And the Filipino bunkhouse was never up to par with that of the white workers, who tended to be the shop staff. You know, they had some kind of a machine shop usually, and operators for the boilers. Those tended to be the white staff. But I remember that they had a kid from Bellingham when I was a kid. And another activity of ours as a kid was catching bullheads and flounders. And we would go on the back of this building here. This larger building came in later when I was younger. I think there's just a not very good Filipino bunkhouse. I think it was just they had to replace it out here so bad. But we used to fish off the back of that. We get down on our bellies and being fishing over the edge. And I remember they had a cook from Bellingham whose name was Art Quick. And I think they cooked a generous amount of food for their white workers. Had a lot of food left over. And we would be out there fishing, and Art Quick would say, would you like some bacon and eggs or ham and eggs or whatever? And that became a thing. He would always bring us leftovers there. They cooked a lot of food for them.
Do you recall either the Filipino or the white cannery workers mixing with the people of Kluwak much, or did they stay to themselves?
Not a lot. No. I mean, I mixed with the Filipinos, I worked with them. But I don't think they mixed a whole lot, although, you know, many Filipinos did marry and settle down. But as a group within the Filipino bunkhouse, I don't recall that there was a whole lot of mixing. But obviously there must have been, because some did marry. And for the white workers, I don't recall that there was mixing. I think in later years more of that happened, but early on there wasn't.
Well, you've answered all of my questions and then some. So, thank you very much.
Okay, well, you're welcome. Just occurred to me, and I remember that, I don't know, there was a Gurry scow that was right next to the cannery. And that's, you know, all the head and guts went into that Gurry scow. And then they would tow it around the point and open it up and empty it out. Just up at, around the point from Kluwak. But, you know, everything out of the fish was thrown away except the portion that was put in cans. And we could get all the salmon eggs, more salmon eggs than we needed or wanted from what was being discarded. No more. It became a very profitable part of the fishery was the salmon eggs.
Oh, yeah.
But then they were just dumped in the Gurry scow and taken around the point. No EPA.
Not in those days.
Well, it'll be interesting what you find out and what you conclude, and I'll report to the